Our next speaker is known, I think, to everybody here, Daryl Castle. Daryl Castle has been with this movement from the beginning, and can't say enough about him. But let me go over his bio here. Daryl was nominated to be the Constitution Party's vice presidential candidate at its national convention in Kansas City in 2008. Serving as a running mate for presidential nominee Chuck Baldwin. Daryl Castle proved to be a tireless campaigner in 2008, setting a blistering pace of campaign appearances from coast to coast. He has barely slowed down in 2009, making numerous public appearances, including his recent address at the end of Fed rally in Kansas City, appearing in radio interviews all over the country and writing several well-received articles in serious matters of public policy. And I might add, in speaking 2 weeks ago, and right across the river, across a couple rivers up here, I guess, at Long Island, and to the New York Constitution Party. Daryl Castle is becoming particularly well-known for offering serious solutions for the troublesome economic problems facing America. Daryl served 2 terms as Constitution Party of Tennessee chairman, is serving his 3rd term as vice chairman of the National Committee, and has served 2 terms as platform chairman at the National Convention. He's also served as chairman of the National Veterans Coalition and outreach of the National Constitution Party in 2007, and is still a member of that organization. Born in Kingsport, Tennessee, Daryl graduated from East Tennessee State University with a BA in history and political science. He received a JD degree from Memphis State University Law School. So also the University of Memphis. Daryl's an attorney in private practices with offices in Memphis, Tennessee, St. Louis, Missouri, and Kansas City, Missouri. The Castle Law Firm specializes in bankruptcy and personal injury. And I don't know about the personal injury, but I would imagine the bankruptcy is picking up and keep on picking up for a while. After graduation from college, Daryl was commissioned as a 2nd lieutenant in the Marine Corps. His service in Vietnam followed a family military tradition. His oldest brother served in the Army during World War II. Another brother served as a Marine in the Korean War. Daryl trained under then 1st Lieutenant Oliver North. After graduation from basic school, Daryl's unit received a unit citation for being deployed in 5 different theaters of operation at the same time. He was promoted to 1st Lieutenant and received orders to the Far East for 13 months. Daryl left the Marine Corps in 1974, a very different person than he was when he went in. It was a life-changing event, and his experience during those years has contributed to the strong belief that war should not be entered into capriciously, and that the decision to go to war must be made according to constitutional provisions. Daryl firmly believes that we must uphold Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution, which makes it clear that only Congress can declare war, that those powers are not granted to the president. Daryl has served the local church as deacon and deacon chairman. In 1998, he and his wife founded Mia's Children Foundation, Inc., which is a Christian organization in Bucharest, Romania, which ministers to homeless gypsy children. Daryl and his wife, Joan, have been married for 30 years. They live in Germantown, Tennessee. Their daughter, Joanna, and her husband, Michael Miller, serve with the Navigators Ministry at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. Since 2005, Daryl has served as on the board of the Conservative Caucus, which is founded and chaired by Constitution Party founder and past presidential nominee Howard Phillips. Let's welcome Daryl Castle.
Thank you, Jim, and thank you for that reception. I Unlike a couple of our other speakers, I don't mind depressing you. I've got 30 years' experience as a bankruptcy lawyer to recommend me for that. But it is depressing. It can be when you look at our situation today in relation to what I do every day in my daily life, which is really represent individuals and small businesses in the bankruptcy courts of the nation. So I've learned a lot about debt in 30 years of doing that, and I can see problems in the country today that could be solved but are not being solved and apparently are not going to be solved. And so this economy, this debt-based system that we have, is going to resolve a lot of the problems that Dr. DeRosa told us about by itself, if something isn't done very quickly to change our direction. The reason I say that is because it may already be too late to resolve these things, but it may not be. I don't know the future exactly. I mean, I can look at the signs. I can look at the sky and tell if it's going to rain, but only God knows the future. But I can tell you this. We backed ourselves into a problem, into a corner with debt and with our economy that are going to be very, very difficult to escape from. And that's because a national government and its economy is not that much different than an individual, if you really think about it. When you have debt, the type that we have, overpowering, strangling type of debt that can't be repaid, it's trouble. You know, people will ask you from time to time about the deficit. You hear about that. The congressman last night told us that we have a $1.8 trillion deficit this year. It's headed for $2 trillion right now because tax revenue is down 34% this year. 34% is a devastating drop in revenue. Debt can only be repaid from income. And what that means is that your income has to exceed your expense. There's no other solution. If you have debt yourself as an individual, if you go to a bank to borrow money, that banker looks at your income expense statement, and if your expenses exceed your income, he would be crazy to loan you money because he sees no way for that debt to be repaid. Well, that's what our government is doing right now every day. It's going to the governments of the world asking for loans, and those governments are looking at the income expense picture and saying no, because you can't pay us back. But we have a solution for that too. But let's look at something that's actually happening now. Recently, we sent Tim Geithner, our Secretary of the Treasury, to China to beg on his knees for more money. This is what a great nation does. It goes to communist dictators and begs them to loan them money so that they can continue to travel around the world and attack the client states of this communist dictatorship. Does that make any sense? Anyway, what happens is when we have a deficit like we have, what that really means is that we are spending more than, we are borrowing more than 50 cents of every dollar that we spend. And so we have to have these loans to fund the $2 trillion almost of deficit spending that we plan to make this year. So we go to the Chinese and ask them to buy our debt. And then to fund our operations, we say, okay, we have $100 billion of debt for sale. We have an auction to people who want to buy it. And we offer it for sale at very, very restricted interest rates. So we're asking these the Chinese to loan us $100 billion by buying our debt, at which we're going to repay at 1 to 2% interest. Actually, that's the interest rate we repay, because we can really never repay the debt because our expenses exceed our income. So let's look at it from the Chinese perspective as to exactly what we're asking them to do. We're asking them to buy $100 billion of debt at which we'll pay 1% to 2% interest. Now, there's a 6% Chinese rate of inflation, and the dollar has lost 15% of its value this year. So, you know, if you were a lender, what would you think about that formula? So what that really adds up to, according to the Wall Street Journal, is that the Chinese have lost $270 billion this year by trading on our debt. It's a formula that they can't tolerate for very long, and so they're not tolerating it. There's a reason why we want interest rates to be so low in these transactions. And that's because we're trying desperately to inflate our currency and debase our currency. Why would we do that? Well, to try to reinflate the housing bubble so that the economy can start again. And see, individuals out there like you and like me are no different than the national government. In that regard, we have so much debt we can't buy anything. We can't charge anything else. And so one in five of our homes now are underwater, our mortgages. In other words, we owe more on the mortgage than the house is worth. So we can't refinance or borrow any more money to keep this economy going. So what the federal government is trying to do is jumpstart housing values so that all these underwater mortgages will be washed out and be removed, and people can go refinance, roll all their unsecured debt into the refinancing, their credit cards and things of that nature, and so then we're all rich again, and we can refinance our homes and go out and start buying more Chinese products. That's how it works, and that's what we're trying to do. But the Chinese have gotten wise to the deal, and they're not buying it, literally. The last time we sold debt in May, or we had a debt auction, there were $59 billion that they refused to buy. And so the Fed, the Federal Reserve, simply steps in and monetizes that debt or buys it themselves. Even though they say, Ben Bernanke says, we're not going to monetize the debt, in the same sentence, he does it. So what that means for us is that we tell the Chinese, okay, if you won't buy our debt, we'll buy it ourselves and just continue to march. So in effect, what we're doing is borrowing money from ourselves so that we can repay it later with interest to these bankers who lend it to us. It's a good deal for them, I suppose. But what it really tells the Chinese, too, is that all of the dollars that we hold are going to be reducing in value very quickly. And they're very concerned about that. It's going to debase our currency and destroy the value of the dollar. I know this sounds kind of strange, but it all makes sense in a way. So what the Chinese have done in response to that is that they are traveling around the world making deals with other countries, swapping their dollars and their products for the products of these other countries. They had done it in the Far East for quite some time with trading partners there, Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore, countries like that, where they go through an even swap so that they can avoid the dollar reserve requirements. In other words, they don't have to convert their currency into dollars. Every time they convert their money into dollars, they lose 15% and growing. So they're looking for ways to avoid doing that. And now they've expanded that to Brazil and Argentina. All of these countries probably enjoy being able to rub our noses in the fact that that they can do this. But what it means for us is it threatens the reserve status of the dollar, which now you can read every day where different countries, China, Russia, and others are saying, you know, the dollar is really not a very good reserve currency anymore because of the deficit, which has to be funded with all this money that the Federal Reserve is printing, they're becoming more and more concerned about it. What would that mean for us if we suddenly lost the dollar as a reserve currency? Well, it would mean instant poverty. This is coming. And this is what's so dangerous about this entire situation, if something isn't done to reverse it. And that's why I say that this situation could solve our problems for us, so that they all merge into one gigantic problem. See, with a $2 trillion deficit, we have no money to fund our imports. We're an import-dependent country. We import 70% of our energy. What would we do unless we could force other countries to convert their currency to dollars to do business on the world markets? What if we had to do that? What if we had to convert our dollars to euros or the Chinese currency in order to import any oil? Every dollar that we did that with would suddenly be worth 41 cents less than it is now. And it would take real money to buy this stuff. No one wants to sell their oil to somebody with a worthless currency. So it would be a very difficult situation. Also, food. If you look in your grocery stores, it's hard to find something now that's not imported. Even in areas like where Joan and I live, that's a farming-based economy. Everybody's got a garden, but you can't find any local food. It's all imported. You know, there's probably a billion onions grown within 10 miles of where we live, but you go in any store, and all the onions are imported from Mexico. We're food dependent on imports, too. So all these things are coming to a head right now at this particular time. And so it's very, very important that these problems be resolved. Now, there are solutions. They're just solutions that we're not going to take. For the reasons, I suppose, that Dr. DeRosa pointed out to us this morning. I mean, this is what I told the people in Long Island when I was there a couple of weeks ago. If you had someone come into you and you asked that person said to you, well, look, I've got some financial problems. I'm in really bad trouble. I need some advice. What would you tell me? And you looked at that person's condition, and his expense side vastly exceeded his income. And you said, look, you've got to curtail spending. You've got to give back this new Mercedes you just bought. You know, you might want to think about selling this home that you can't afford anymore. And you've got to start living without luxuries and just spending on absolute necessities until you can get your expense side down and your income side up. You can start reducing this debt. The government is no different. It's the same thing we should be telling them. Now, that flies in the face of Keynesian economics, which says when you're out of money, you spend money because that's what makes the economy work. Money is credit, so you have to induce people to go into debt further. But most people in this country are tapped out right now, and so all these banks are holding on to the money that we gave them recently. You may have seen just a couple of days ago several of these banks, I think it was five, actually, Goldman Sachs, Citibank, and some others, gave back $68 billion of bailout money. They were permitted to do that. The government doesn't permit every bank that wants to repay this money to do so, but it did these banks. And why were they able to do that? Well, because the money that we gave them in the bailout, they never did anything with. They just held it in their cash accounts, didn't turn loose of any of it in the form of credit. And the taxpayers, we the people, assumed their bad debt so that their books looked so much better. Their stock took off and skyrocketed. All this money came in, and they used it to repay the bailout money. And now we're stuck with the bad debt, which we have guaranteed. Now it's like $14 trillion worth of this debt that the taxpayers are on the hook for. $14 trillion really means in the future, what it means for us is it's impossible to have growth when you have that kind of debt. You know, you hear these things like debt and deficit, but what do they really mean for people. They mean that in the future, if you're of retirement age or nearing it, your retirement is going to be a lot less prosperous than you thought it was, because the dollars that you're paid, which are finite, are going to be worth a lot less than you thought they were. It's going to make it very difficult for your children and grandchildren to be prosperous in the future. It works kind of like this. Let's say that you had a good job and made a good living and had a nice home in a nice suburb somewhere. And every year you get a bonus at the end of the year, you know, from your work. But you have so much debt that you've built up. There's so many things that you pay for, most of them long since forgotten and collecting dust somewhere. But all of the money that you make above bare living expenses goes to debt service. And when you get your bonus at the end of the year, even if it's $10,000, that just goes to fund this debt. That's the life that you have to look forward to. That's where we are. And that's why there can't be any growth or prosperity. I mean, this is a commitment in America to a non-prosperous nation. Something has got to be done about debt and how it's paid before growth can restart and the economy can restart. That is the only solution. And so what it means is there's coming a default in one form or another on this debt. Just as you might cancel this person who came to see you, once you looked at his situation and you saw that it was unsolvable or irreversible, you know that one way or another, either through bankruptcy or some other method, he's going to default on that debt. So the method we've chosen right now is default by stealth, or fraud by stealth, or counterfeiting by stealth, whatever you want to call it. But what it really means is trying every way possible to inflate and debase the currency so that we can pay the Chinese with far undervalued dollars. In other words, every dollar that they loan us, we pay them back with 90 cents, then 85, then 70. And that's what we've chosen to do. That's our method of default. And we'll see how well it works in the future. But as we near full bankruptcy status, it gets more and more difficult to manage and more difficult to cover up. And the countries of the world are starting to get alarmed about it, as I said. So we have a solution all in mind for that. How are we going to fund this $2 trillion deficit this year? This year, we propose to spend $2 trillion more than we take in, and the Federal Reserve is just going to print that money. Although that's kind of a misnomer, they just create it from thin air, which devalues every dollar that you carry around in your pocket and robs you of savings and things like that. They're debasing your currency and robbing you just like they are the Chinese. But still, it's the only solution. It's expensive to run the world. I was in a meeting with somebody last spring, just before the campaign started in 2008. And this gentleman, we were talking to him, me and a couple of other people, about the wars and the role of the United States in the world. And he said, "Look, we're a global power. We have to do these things. Yeah, this is how a global power behaves now, I guess." But, you know, one of the pieces of bad news that we've learned since January, since the Obama administration was inaugurated, is that Democrats are just as stupid as Republicans when it comes to running the economy. You may think that that is good news, but it really isn't. Because we thought there might be some hope for fiscal sanity, but what they've just done, this is right on top of the figures that I just gave you. This is what a bankrupt nation does when the budget is already set. They just voted a few days ago, $100 billion more for the wars for this year that we don't have. It's going to take $100 billion, they tell us, to rescue GM. This is money that doesn't exist. Now, think about that for a minute. $100 billion for the government to take over and own 70% of this corporation just 2 years ago, the biggest company in the world. And you ask yourself where that leaves Ford and what Ford would think. If you were CEO of Ford, what would you think of that? You might think, you know, this is great for us. We're the only survivor, you know. But what if you had to compete against a company that had $100 billion of government money? You know, as a lawyer, if you've ever litigated against government lawyers, you know how difficult it is because they have unlimited budgets and they can run you around all over the world. I had one tell me once, well, let's go to Dubai. If you want to take this guy's deposition, let's go to Dubai and do it. We can bring him back from, he was in Kuwait, I think. I said, no, I can't go to Dubai. You know, my client can't afford to send me to Dubai, but his client could, because it has the Federal Reserve to print money for him. But anyway, it might be more difficult for Ford, than you might think in that environment. But, we'll see what kind of cars, the administration produces through GM. I'm anxious to see that. So $100 billion for GM. Also, just recently, the Obama administration has decided to give $100 billion to the International Monetary Fund, so that they can do these special drawing rights, which essentially is a world currency that allows world governments through the UN to draw from this money to use however they see fit, supposedly to help third world countries recover from economic devastation and things like that. Another $100 billion. President Obama just announced in his speech in Cairo the other day that he was going to give $7.5 billion to Afghanistan and Pakistan to non-military aid to rebuild infrastructure and help them repair the bomb damage and so forth from the wars, which is one of our big tactics. You know, our banks fund the wars and the destruction of foreign countries. Then they fund the rebuilding of the countries later on. And, of course, then we get to bomb them again. There's, you know, there's nothing like making extra targets for yourself. But that's all money that doesn't exist and that we don't have. And so there's no end to it. And, you know, the level of stupidity, either, you know, we're either committing suicide or someone is killing us. Take your pick. But that seems to be the way of our future. Now, this is all funded right now by money created by our central banking system, the Federal Reserve banks, which, of course, as you all know, are owned by the commercial banks in their area, which are owned by private stockholders. We don't know for sure what that is, but most people suspect that the private stockholders are primarily foreign banks, which could explain why the Federal Reserve is so interested in not telling us what they're doing with their money. You may be following the story of Ron Paul's bill to try to audit the Fed. It's pretty presumptuous of us to ask the Federal Reserve to tell us what they're doing with $13 trillion of money that we gave them or that they gave us or whatever. But they seem very interested in not doing that, and they're very nervous about it. You know, they've hired a lobbyist. You may have read that. Linda Robertson, she has been in the Treasury Department for a few years. But before that, she was the chief lobbyist for Enron. That's the person that they hired to lobby Congress to prevent Congress from voting for this audit. And that in itself is a conflict of interest and a fraud on the American people, because the American people are paying a lobbyist to lobby against their best interest. But that's the way the world is now. The rule of law is another victim of this whole thing. That's one example. Another example that's been brought up several times, it was in the resolutions that we passed this time, the rule of law in the GM bailout. Is a violation of the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause. But also, if you think about it, this year, last count I had, which was just a couple of days ago, 36 banks have failed. 36 28 in all of last year, 38 so far this year. And according to the Wall Street Journal, they estimate maybe 150 will fail this year. Those are banks that are selected to fail or allowed to fail, while others are too big to fail. We decide which banks survive, and so we're going to end up through all of this with just a handful of huge international financial conglomerates that run the world. These banks that are too big to fail, well, you might ask yourself, what makes a bank too big to fail? Well, it has to have $100 billion of assets. If it has $100 billion of assets, it's too big to fail. And so we have to help it not fail by giving it money. There are 19 of those banks with $100 billion of assets in the United States. Those are the banks that were put through the stress test recently, supposedly a stress test. And 9 of those banks passed the stress test. That doesn't mean they're solvent. It just means that they can survive without much more money. These 19 banks are the ones that we decided are not too big to fail. I mean, are too big to fail, but the others we just let fail. And they refuse to tell us why. They refuse to tell us why they let Lehman Brothers fail, but the rest of them not fail. These are all equal protection issues, too. Of course, I mean, not that I think we should bail out all these tiny little banks. I don't think we should bail out any of them. No one bails me out when I have problems, although, you know, I've cried about it from time to time, but no one does anything about it. You know, it's like that cartoon I saw the other day where the little kid has a lemonade stand. He has a sign on the lemonade stand that says lemonade, $15 a glass. And the girl comes by and she says, $15, how can you charge $15? And he says, well, I've got expenses, you know, I've got to buy sugar and lemons and all this stuff, and I have to make a profit. And she looks in and she says, this looks just like muddy water. And he said, well, it is muddy water. And so she walks away and doesn't buy anything, and he goes home and tells his mother that he needs to be bailed out. His business is failing. All of these things that are happening to us now have a solution. And the solution, obviously, is to reduce expenses, reduce taxes, because if you don't reduce expenses and you don't reduce taxes, you can't have growth either. But as we've said many times, the best form of taxation by the federal government on the American people is no tax. I imagine that would stimulate the economy. If the president walked in tomorrow and said, guess what, after today there will be no income tax in America, I bet there would be an immediate stimulating growth in the economy. But I've been down the list of things that should be done many times, but I want to leave you by telling you that there's a few items of good news out there in all this. Some of those are real bright spots. This audit the Fed bill, which now has 218 co-sponsors, it's going to make it through the House, but the Senate is already maneuvering. The Republicans are joining the Democrats to prevent this bill from passing because they apparently are very reluctant to tell us what they're doing with this money. But that is a bright spot. If it passes, the next step is people are going to become outraged when they see what's actually there. And then this end of Fed bill would have a good chance of passing. And we could have real monetary reform if that happened, if it's not too late. Another thing that's about to happen is this fall in September, Ron Paul's book, End the Fed, is set for publication, and it's undoubtedly going to be a bestseller, which will be a good thing, because the more light you shine, as they say, sunshine is the best disinfectant. And Thomas Wood's book, Meltdown, has been a big success and has opened a lot of people's eyes. A lot of people are starting to become aware of what's happening and actually pressing for types of reform. And the fact that we're here in this meeting just talking about these issues are important. So there are some bright spots, but whether these things can be resolved in time or not, time will tell. We'll see. But I wanted to leave you not too depressed about it, but with the fact that if something isn't done, and soon, to reverse the situation with debt and deficit, bad things are going to happen. And so whether the economy can grow and pull out of this tailspin, to me it doesn't look good. It doesn't look good for the future. And I really don't expect this administration to be able to make the changes that have to be made. I've seen no sign that it can. And whether we can make it through to another one or not, time will tell. So that's all I have for you. I appreciate the reception that you've given Joan and me this weekend. It's been great, and I've really enjoyed it.